The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today I want to talk again about monarchy, a monarchy in both the Russian context, historically and theologically, as well as the development of divine kingship in the Old Testament. And the two of these, of course, are very closely related because, in general terms, Orthodox monarchy takes as its basis and as its root the development of the monarchy with all of its problems in ancient Israel. So the two of these are very closely related. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to deal with some of the primary sources, specifically the writings of St. Philaret of Moscow on monarchy, and then some basic observations about the concept of monarchy in the Old Testament. As far as St. Philaret is concerned, I want to thank Vladimir Moss, who has done a lot of the translation of St. Philaret's political writings into English, a lot of it for the first time. And one of the things that Moss does in his historical studies is not so much analyze the issues, but rather he spends a huge amount of time translating the primary source documents into English, often for the very first time, never been in English before, and his case is made not so much by his own writing, but by the primary sources that he brings into English. So when you read his books, his historical books, what you get really are these very long quotations and citations from the church fathers or major figures in European history, rather than actual analysis. So what Moss is really doing is a very valuable service. He's not so much worried about his own opinions in these things, but rather he is giving the reader the opportunity to read the primary sources for himself. And for that, I thank him. Now, St. Philaret and in the work that Moss has translated is extremely worthwhile for those interested in Russian history, those interested in monarchy and the relations between the two. St. Philaret is the Metropolitan of Moscow and one of the most significant figures in the 19th century Russian church. He was also a catechist and an apologist, and he is a figure of immense importance also in Russian political philosophy. But his concern was, from a political point of view, defending the monarchy from the attacks made against it by modern political theory in the West, specifically contract theory, utilitarianism, the work of Mill, everything. By the time of St. Philaret in Russia in the 19th century, the work of a lot of the Western tradition had been translated into Russian. So St. Philaret is a monarchist and has laid out with tremendous skill the case and the defense for monarchy. But it should be noted, and this actually comes up, and I haven't mentioned it, I should, that without Christianity, without the Orthodox Church in the Russian case, monarchy doesn't make much sense. I mean, unless you believe in the tradition, and you believe the scriptures and in the church, and how it's functioned in Russian society, Russian monarchy is an eccentric institution. Despite the attempt of Peter the First to suppress the religious tradition of Russia, he banned you know, icon processions, and he banned really any overt expression of the faith in at least in urban Russia. And a lot of his supporters, Prokopovich in Ukraine and some others, they reduced the Russian monarchy really to the arguments of Thomas Hobbes. And Thomas Hobbes is not a monarchist. I mean, I've dealt with that in some of my writings. He's very much part of the occult materialist movement in England and really has nothing to do with monarchy in the way that we're talking about it. St. Philaret wants to defend the crown not as a political institution. And he also, as I've said many times, as a lot of different monarchists have said over the years, he wants to separate the crown from the state. The monarchy and the state are two very different things. The monarchy is essentially a religious authority. The state is a political and economic power. Those are two very different things. And over the years, over the generations in Russian society, the gap between the state and the monarchy grew wider. But because there really is no fashionable Western theory to make sense out of that, the modern academics really don't talk about it very much. And I'm talking about this in a strictly academic context. In the American universities, you will not get any deep analysis of this because in the prejudices of the American historian, the nobility, the monarchy, the state, the army, the church, to a great extent, are ultimately considered as one and the same thing. And this is exactly how the Russian liberals and then later Marxists had interpreted this society. It was this monolithic power that imposed itself upon society. The reality, of course, is a lot more nuanced than that. And that nuance and subtlety comes out substantially in the work of St. Philaret, as Moss has translated him. St. Philaret really begins by really wanting to see a union, an effective emotional and religious, a spiritual union between the crown on the one hand and the nation on the other. Philaret, like so many at the time and in the Russian church, is both a royalist and a nationalist. He's a nationalist in that the state takes its legitimacy because it is connected historically and spiritually with a specific group of people, overwhelmingly the Russian-speaking Orthodox people of the empire. And this is proven by the fact that Philaret views the monarchy as a representation of the nation as a whole. He is a representative institution. He is almost like a Platonic form that contains in and of itself the best and truest elements of the population as filtered through the lens of its Orthodox tradition. Now, for St. Philaret, writing when he is concerned about firmness. This is something that concerns the state more than it does the monarchy. Again, and I've said this on this show many times, and it's worth repeating, there's a big difference between authority and power. Power is coercive. Power, by its definition, is coercive. It's neutral. It can go in any direction. It doesn't necessarily have a moral purpose, but of course it should. Authority is that moral purpose. Somebody may have the authority to do something, but absolutely no power to do something. And this is what Nicholas I said in his early years as a monarch of the empire, that the state, the bureaucracy, the nobility serving in Petersburg often works in opposition to what I'm trying to do as Tsar of Russia. It seems that and I don't want to exaggerate this distinction. It can be exaggerated. I don't want to go too far with it. But the big issue here is that is that, you know, there's this issue between administration and authority. Administration is this bureaucratic method of organized, repetitious, and routinized coercion. And that's not necessarily a negative thing, but to the extent that these two institutions are separate from one another, the actual authority of the crown dissipates. Nicholas I starts his Majesty's own chancery because he wants an institution that could go around the politics of the nobility. And there is absolutely no guarantee whatsoever that the average literate noble working in Petersburg has any particular interest in either the religious or mystical connection between the Tsar and the people. In fact, in many cases, you read this in Gogol and Dostoevsky, that the rank and file bureaucrat is often in opposition to the crown, and that opposition often comes from simple ignorance or the idea that I, as a noble, am entitled to this role. The bureaucracy in Petersburg was attacked as much by monarchists as it was by liberals and leftists. Dostoevsky does it over and over again, and Gogol practically made his career on it. The other thing, I mean, St. Philaret also will say that the state ultimately is, if Philaret defines the word state in the same way that people like Hegel and the German Romantic school define the word state, it's not bureaucratized, more or less efficient coercion. It's a cultural tradition. It's a religious tradition manifest in the day-to-day a work of a bureaucracy. Now, that identity is never perfect, of course. But the goal, and even, you know, Nicholas I made a big deal about this, the goal is to narrow that gap as much as possible. So St. Philaret, using the concept of state, really he's using the concept of state as we would use the concept of nation. But a government is something different. A government is the manifestation of this tradition. So, in the way that Moss has translated Philaret, the concept of state is this essential cultural and religious entity that doesn't necessarily have to be manifest at any given time. But it exists. It exists even if there's no government. But the government is, in fact, the bureaucracy. So, in the past, I've used, the concepts are the same, but our vocabulary is different. A nation exists whether or not the state exists. The church exists whether or not the state exists. These are as much immaterial ideas as they are actual functioning things. Government, in St. Philaret's mind, is the manifestation of these ideal entities. And because it's a physical, day-to-day human manifestation, it's going to make mistakes, it's going to do stupid things, and most importantly, it might not represent the mentality of the authority, and that is the crown. The bureaucracy takes whatever authority it has from the crown. In and of itself, it attracts loyalty only because people can make a living from it. It's somewhat prestigious to live in Petersburg and have this kind of government job. It doesn't mean, you know, you read Dostoevsky and Turgenev and Gogol, you see that, you know, they love to make fun of the incompetence. A lot of these people have no education relative to public service, and therefore they're there because they're nobles and they have a right to it. So the bureaucracy is not an issue. And only once in a while does it come up in this massive literature on Russian monarchy, 18th, 19th century, that the bureaucracy has its own agenda, it has its own way of life and way of thought, and it may or may not be representative of the Tsar. And so the point is that when you deal with Russian history in this period, you need to be very careful. Is this royal policy? is this the royal idea, or is this the royal idea as filtered through a very large bureaucracy? And I should note for you that, bureaucratically speaking, the Petersburg monarchy, relative to the population of Russia, is actually very small. In absolute numbers, it's very large. But government officials per thousand of the population, you know, per capita, per thousand of the population, for example, is very low in Russia relative to Prussia, France, Great Britain. And France actually has the highest per capita government servants or bureaucrats. The great evil, and this is relevant to, we talk about bureaucracy or police or people in general, the great evil is self-will. The idea that my ideas and my way of thought should be imposed on everyone around me, and that I am the be-all and end-all of government and politics, that's an evil. That is not a part of Russian monarchy, and that just goes to sharpen our understanding of Peter I, whose entire existence was based on self-will. From a more general political point of view, the real problem of self-will is that it leads to chaos. Now, I avoid the word anarchy because that's actually a very specific political concept. Chaos is just this irregularity in how people live their lives. You can't plan anything. You can't build anything in a period of chaos because you have no idea how long it's going to last. But from a realistic point of view, the real problem with chaos is that it always leads to repression. This goes back to Plato. The idea is that when you have a self-willed people, and Plato referred to this as a democratic people, he defined democracy as the obsession with the individual will, which leads to violence and destruction in society as everyone's fighting everyone else. But this can only lead, inevitably but naturally, to repression. Now, just as significant, you know, St. Philaret is dealing with government, state, nation, crown, etc., as metaphysical principles. And this is really an aspect of the brilliance of St. Philaret. He is absolutely influenced by Fichte and Hegel. Not that he was a follower of theirs, but that kind of the conceptualization of these centers of power is very similar to Hegel. And both men, Hegel and St. Philaret, define the essence of the people, the nation, the spiritual unity of the Russian people, Orthodox Slavic people, and he's very specific about that. That is their most essential and significant self. This is deeply Hegelian. There is, for those of you who may have read Ludwig Feuerbach, who was Marx's primary influence and teacher, not Hegel. Marx was a stern critic of Hegel, but he was a follower of Feuerbach. Feuerbach made the claim that God is not real. He's not real. He is, however, a projection of the alienation of incomplete human beings. Human beings who are suffering will project their desires onto this otherworldly entity and call it God. Now, Feuerbach was taken to heart by Marx, and Feuerbach's idea was applied, really became the central psychological and philosophical part of Marx, and as well as Bakunin and the anarchist movement. But, you know, they said that not only is God this projection of these suffering people, but so is the state. Now, the problem with Feuerbach is that, you know, it doesn't make tons of sense to project certain members of, say, the Assyrian or Roman pantheon. A lot of these people are extremely immoral by the standards of the time. If Feuerbach is right, then he has to explain how some of the most vile and violent of the gods and goddesses of the ancient world somehow serve as a projection of this desire for utopia. You know, this is an argument against Christianity, not an argument against the gods as such. But the point of bringing up Feuerbach is that St. Philaret says that there's no problem there. That is what the state is. It doesn't mean that it's false or that it's some kind of psychological compensation or defense mechanism, but that is the very justification of the authority of the Tsar, the authority of the monarch, because he is truly a recipient of the projection of the deepest desires and needs of the population. That's why he's representative. He's not representative because he's been voted into office, although Tsars like Mikhail and some others have been voted into office. In general, the hereditary principle in the 19th century is significant and dominant. But the idea of this projection is not a problem. In fact, it's the opposite. It's one of the great aspects that justify the existence of monarchy. The individual by himself is pretty worthless. The individual by himself doesn't have any power. Unless you're Bill Gates, the individual really doesn't count for much. But when your selfhood at its best and personality at its best can be represented by an ancient historical tradition that serves to defend you to the extent possible, that then increases your significance as an individual. So St. Philaret posits in you know, very good German fashion, and I think correctly, that the monarchy, with its symbolism and with its tradition, is in fact the very selfhood of the population. It's the people combining their moral authority into an office, an institution, a set of very, very important symbols, and symbol, by the way, in the true realist sense of the word, not in the nominalist sense of the word. It is a legitimate projection of the basic needs of the people. The Tsar is the nation. He is a metaphysical principle before he is anything else. He is the best of the historical tradition. Now, it should be noted that St. Philaret, like almost everyone at the time, held that the church should be independent of the state. He decries this perversion of the Byzantine symphony between church and state that was brought about by Peter the Great. Peter the Great essentially despised the church. He was a Freemason and a materialist. He was an occultist. My personal opinion is that he was mentally ill, if not straight out possessed. But what he created was a church that was financially dependent upon the state and hence could be controlled by it, at least at its higher levels. Things were changing in the middle of the 19th century. Now, the relation between church and state is significant here. If the state comes from God, then the life of the church, how God has manifested himself to the people, becomes more significant and more important than politics and the state. The state, as this organization of coercion, is radically secondary. From a strictly ontological point of view, the authority of the crown, deriving from logos, from the order of things, from the cosmic order, which is partially represented by the crown, this is primary. It's primary in every sense of that word. Therefore, the apparatus of bureaucracy, this derives from it, only has reality because it derives from it, and takes whatever authority it has from that principle. Therefore, the apparatus is secondary. The Tsar is only what he is because of his connection with the church, and that's significant because what we're talking about here is mirroring the action of Logos in nature. I know I've said this before, but the concept of divine right has been so abused and misinterpreted by moderns. It really is, I mean, for lack of a better word, a Stoic principle. It has to do with mirroring and representing in physical form the regularity of the law of nature. Okay, we will continue on this topic when we return.
Don't go away because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We're talking about St. Philaret and the Russian Tsarist idea. And we're really dealing with the conceptual mentality of St. Philaret and how he's sort of taking certain aspects of German philosophy, which were absolutely dominant in Russia at the time, and making sense out of them. I think this is very proper from an Orthodox point of view in the Russian national context. And his basic proposition is that the church is more significant than the state, speaking broadly, and the Tsar is only significant, morally speaking, because the Tsardom imitates and mirrors the law of nature. The church, in very good Slavophile fashion, is not a power. It doesn't coerce. The church as an institution, not the church as an instrument of the state or the state in the name of God. I'm not referring to that. I'm talking about the church as such. Perverts itself when it uses physical coercion. Christ did not lay out canon law for the church. The canons are to the church in the same way that the bureaucracy is to the nation. They are dependent. They're parasitic on the moral authority and tradition of those institutions. Without that kind of authority, power is not only arbitrary and meaningless, but evil. This kind of written law, words on a page, they are an authority only because they take some of it from the institutions that promulgate them. But even more than that, they are abbreviations of that tradition. This was, by the way, my doctoral dissertation on Michael Oakeshott. The reason that I did my dissertation on Oakeshott is because he's talking about the basis for a political revolution, whether it be Russian or French or British. And one of his primary lines of argument is that any written constitution, any written code of law, or even when you verbalize the main elements of a code of law, and it could be canon law, it could be civil law, the point is that that receives authority only because it participates in the much broader tradition of any specific group of people. In other words, law is far larger than what might be written down on paper. The church is far larger than the scriptures, than the canons, than all of these essays and exhortations. Those things have a very important purpose, but because they rely on the written word, they only mirror abbreviations of the tradition. The tradition is always much, much larger than that which can be written down on paper. The church as an institution has its being through prayer, the sacraments, the life of grace. This is primary. This is what St. Seraphim of Sarov was talking about when he says that we are to acquire the Holy Spirit and these other things, these laws and these physical things, the physical manifestation, you know, the sacraments and the icons and everything else, they are assistants that bring us to the Holy Spirit. And that's what they are. They're secondary. They're significant. They're important. Most of the time, they're indispensable, but it needs to be held that they are secondary. This is of importance in terms of the state as well as the church. The external form is secondary. The faith and grace is primary. Therefore, if the law of the church, for whatever reason, conflicts with this progress towards grace due to differing circumstances and other, you know, crises and problems like that, then the law is to be abrogated. The law is secondary. Grace is primary. These things serve as canals to bring us to the truth of the matter. They focus our attention to bring us to the truth of the matter. And that's the case with law, and that's the case with canons. It's the case with all of these physical manifestations of that which isn't inherently physical. So this is not a dualism. It's symbolism in the truest non-nominalist or realist sense of the word. When I did my talk on Ivanov and the Russian symbolist, this came up again. A symbol is not essentially separate from what it symbolizes. It's merely a physical manifestation of a spiritual reality that's far larger than the physical manifestation. But because we're human beings and we have five senses and we have a physical part to ourselves, we require that kind of guide, almost a fence or the banks of a river, something that canalizes the movement of something. For St. Philaret, the state has substantial limitations. The state, defined as the coercive bureaucracy, needs to be kept in check. Again, this is a problem of self-will. Anybody who is knowledgeable about the politics of 19th century Russia realizes that one of the most significant problems is the arrogance of the nobility as they ruled in Petersburg, often at cross purposes with the monarchy. What matters is the concept of unity. We've dealt with subordinost and the Ukrainian variant, subornopravan, on this show before and in some detail. But the way that the Slavophiles understood this sort of spiritual unity, partaking both of grace on the one hand and the manifestation of natural law, logos, on the other hand, this is a check upon the state. People like Edmund Burke commented that the more coercion that a society requires, the less healthy that society must be. If the law were truly internalized, then coercion would be the exception rather than the rule. And the idea that if there is less discipline within the individual, within the family, within the parishes and monasteries, their internal discipline is immediately connected with the necessity of external violence. And the point being, if people become more and more self-willed and more arrogant, the bureaucracy usually responds with more and more violence and repression. So in really any political society, regardless of its basis, self-will is self-refuting because it invites state sanctions. The state, however, in the best sense of the word, the sense that St. Philaret uses it, it's rooted, to put it very simply, it's a imitation of the family. Now, for Hegel, this is extremely significant, and it's clearly the fact that he, St. Philaret, connects the family to the state is proof of how significant Hegel's work was in Russia at the time. It's not merely an analogy. It's not merely that the state takes some authority because it imitates the family. Clearly, a monarchy has the family as its ground. The family, not the individual, is the smallest naturally occurring unit in human life. The individual, as isolated, can't live. A baby is born dependent, not free. Therefore, the real issue is that the individual is not the unit of nature for human beings. But what Philaret, Hegel, and so many others within this natural law tradition, what they're talking about is that the state is a natural outgrowth from the family. A parish, a monastery, a diocese, at their best, these aren't strictly human inventions. These are manifestations of logos, how it operates in society. One of the great proofs that nominalism is a destructive lie, one of the most destructive philosophical concepts that's ever been developed, is that when we observe nature, unless you are already committed to the nominalist idea, you don't see individual things. If you take an individual object of whatever kind and analyze it, you're automatically wrong because you have taken it out of its context. The individual is an individual only because it is part of a system. It's an organic system. A system has a kind of a connotation of being mechanical, and I don't want to say that. These are organic organizations. These are true units. The individual is not the object in the sense that we normally think of a tree or a person or a rock. No, the unit of logos, natural law, the way that Christ has manifested himself in nature, is the organization. It is the ecosystem. It's how the soil feeds the tree, how the sun is synthesized by the leaves of a tree or a flower. Taking a flower, plucking it out of the ground, and treating it as an object in and of itself is already to totally distort what you're looking at. And it's no different in society. The individual, from a strictly metaphysical point of view, in the realist tradition of which St. Philaret is representative, the individual does not exist. The individual is absolutely dependent upon the system, the organic institutions which have given birth to it and raised it. Now, that's not to say that individuals don't have certain rights and obligations and duties within that context. But the more significant fact is that the individual is only such because it is born and raised within a specific context. Without it, the individual would die, would never be able to develop in the first place. And this is one of the reasons that I have no patience for the theory of evolution, because a theory of evolution assumes that nominalism is true. But in fact, the objects of nature are not objects. The true individual of nature are ecosystems. They're systems of very complex relationships, starting with DNA and ending up with the entire cosmos. They all are outgrowths of one another, in that they are very complex societies, so to speak. So when St. Philaret and those who support that general point of view, Hegel and many others, referring to the Tsar as the father of the family, is not just an analogy. It's more than that. It is an outgrowth. It is an organic development from the family to, let's say, the clan, to the small town, to a much larger nation with the monarch as its head. I mean, you have the, the nuclear family, the extended family, then the parishes or monasteries, also these kind of unions, whatever you want to say, human life exists as a series of organizations, not as a series of isolated individuals. And therefore, the opposite works as well. Each family is a mini-monarchy. So, the concept is, in the most general sense, that an organization with strong leadership based on traditional models, not on self-will, but on traditional models, and some of that tradition, a small portion of that tradition, might be written down. But what's written is abstract in Hegel's sense of the word. If you take it as, you know, like Protestants take the Bible and totally separate it from the institutions, the monastics and church synods and everything else that helped gather up the materials, put them all together, and interpret them as a single whole. Scriptures or any other object doesn't exist in and of itself. It exists as part of a broader organic system. And therefore, it is a reflection of nature, not merely because it is hierarchical. Hierarchical in the best sense of the word. The spirit is always higher, so to speak, than matter. But it's a reflection of how logos manifests itself in matter. And that is the creation of systems. Systems that then depend on other systems around it. And ultimately, that's why evolution is false. Because you can't talk about an object unless you talk about the system that has given it its sustenance. And then that system is itself dependent on other systems around it all the way to the cosmos. Therefore, the only reason an individual exists is because the cosmos exists. That's the problem. You know, modernity is based on nominalism. The only way to fight modernity and its ideology most manifest in liberalism and all the senses of that word is to reject it in the way that Hegel, Bernard Bosanquet, St. Philaret, so many others of that era, Pope Honesty of the Slavophiles, the Romantic Nationalist Movement, on and on and on and on. It has rejected modernity because it is realist in its metaphysics, not nominalist. This is absolutely essential. Okay, we only have a few minutes, and I wanted to talk a little bit about these principles laid down by St. Philaret of Moscow and so many others in that era, both East and West, in defending the institution of monarchy and nationalism in the sense of the ethnic and religious tradition of the people. It can only be done in a realist vein. Nominalism doesn't believe that there are natural organizations. There's only individuals. Therefore, anything other, I mean, ultimately, than Hobbes or Nietzsche can't be made sense out of, at least from a point of view of natural and organic organization. But in the Old Testament, it's no different. In the development of the Israelite monarchy, for all of its problems, and of course Solomon is the ultimate problem. Solomon is the very icon of the New World Order, quite literally, actually. The king, in the way that the prophet Samuel lays out the basic constitution, so to speak, of the Israelite king, is that it's not primarily about power. And St. Philaret has already said that here. It's not about power. When the monarch does something, it is the unification of all aspects of the society, the state, the military, the economy, the people, the religion, the tradition, their enemies, their friends, their topography and climate. All of this are united. Unless it takes all of this into account and creates this unified, integrated, and yet natural entity, the state, in this sense, is illegitimate. Spirit and matter, as we've already intimated, spirit and matter are united into one entity. Spirit and matter are not opposites. spirit and matter are counterparts. But because human beings are people with flesh, people with physical components, we need the material world, but the material world never separated from the spiritual world. From our human point of view, the two require each other. The monarch in the Old Testament is lawgiver and judge. Based upon this natural law concept of logos, it is not based on the whim of the ruler. A monarch is absolute. A monarch is representative of God only in the sense that he mirrors the natural organization and hierarchy of nature as a whole. There is no real distinction between the organic unity of natural systems, ecosystems, for example, and hierarchy. Hierarchy in this sense only refers to the fact that that which is spirit is more real than that which is material, because material is the very principle of being an individual. And again, this is something that is rejected by nominalism, because they only see chunks of matter, pieces of things, as the only reality. Everything else is created by the mind, not actually there in the natural world. So the hierarchy is based on the extent to which spirit is more comprehensive and hence more real than matter. Matter is radically individualized. Now, in the Old Testament, in the work of the prophets, absolutely, but more specifically the prophet Samuel, these monarchies are limited by tradition, the priesthood, local customs, the way that localities have done things. And this, again, Solomon will violate all of these and die a complete heretic. Local elites, military forces, external enemies, all of these, and not just in the Old Testament, but all of these are the variables that limit and hem in the power of a monarch. And the minute that a monarch violates these things, as Solomon did, he no longer is legitimate. And as in the case of Solomon, it's a pattern that repeats itself. As Solomon begins to violate all of these traditional restraints of the two monarchs before him, David and Saul, he begins to rely more and more on the physical, the material. He brings in more wives. He brings in more pagan gods. He wants more money. The minute you abandon the natural order, this is, Marcus Aurelius says this, and this is of ancient origin, certainly before the period of kings in the Old Testament. This is everywhere. The minute you deviate from the natural order, you then begin to rely on dead matter for your power. Money, manipulation of images, the creation of propaganda, whatever you need to bridge that gap. But the monarchy is a military leader. He is the incarnation of the Platonic form of justice. He is holy because he represents a holy people. When I say holy, I don't refer to actually how they behave, but the fact that they are chosen out of the nations to represent divine justice. I think this was the case in Old Israel. I think this is the case in Old Russia. And like Old Israel, these Orthodox states obey the law of God, often only in the breach. You know, the whole Old Testament is the prophets and other leaders condemning Israel for its constant deviation from the law of God. The monarch is trained from birth for this role. In the Old Testament, as well as in the work of St. Philaret, very much part of the royalist tradition, that we define freedom as not this self-will. It's a typical nominalism. If the individual is the only thing that exists, then the only way to define freedom is the individual to do whatever they want. That's a necessity for the nominalist way of thinking. Freedom cannot be self-will because self-will is based on the passions. We call them passions because they are the opposite of actions. Passions are dictated from outside. Passions exist because material objects exist. Unless a material object is brought under its proper form and hence its proper purpose and end, our lives are inherently irrational. Freedom is internal control. The unification of our mind and grace for the sake of living the rational life, defined as putting the material object under its proper form, under its proper idea, which provides it with its definition, its end, its purpose. Hence, freedom is this internal freedom. You are not free if you're dictated to by some addiction or some fetish. You're only free if you could lead a rational life. So the fact is that St. Philaret's view of monarchy is part of the universal and perennial tradition of royalist thought, starting at least from the Christian point of view in the Old Testament, but you know it exists all over the world as well, and is part of the perennial tradition, the natural law tradition, the manifestation of logos everywhere, that this has more or less been the basic approach of all royal societies in history. Whether or not they obey them is another matter, but that's the standard, that's the ideal. So anyway, I've gone a little bit over. I apologize for that. I thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned into Radio Aryan.